Bubala with you, Radio 720 WGN. I just got off of a plane. I flew twice last week, and I swear it never fails. And I know it's like when you're buying a new car, you see the car you're interested in on the road a million times. It seems without fail when I fly, there's something happens. And I'm always thankful it's not me, I guess, or I feel like it's some weird world according to Garp thing where once that happens, that means everybody else is safe for a while. But we've all been watching the Germanwings story of the last week, the plane that was apparently, it seems, taken into a mountainside by its co-pilot. Joining us in studio right now is Diane Damos from Damos Aviation Services. Thanks so much for coming in tonight.
You're most welcome.
So explain to me what your company does. You help select pilots. How and for who?
We work for airlines. We work for flying training schools. We work for governments. We consult with the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy. So just about anybody.
And so you don't actually help select pilots for a specific airline, but you help give them guidelines, help advise on what tests they should run, different things like that?
Exactly. We wouldn't get directly involved in saying, take this person and not this person, mm-hmm. but we would set up the selection system for them, tell them what tests to use, tell them about cutoff scores, and then basically set up the process that they would use.
How much of the testing is based just on skill and technical ability versus mental capability?
It depends on whether you're looking at a beginning pilot or an experienced pilot for an airline.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have someone who wants to be a pilot, but they don't know how to fly, so they're just going to start their flight training, of course you can't test the flying skills.
Sure.
So what we have to do is test their abilities and their skills, and we know what makes a good pilot, basically. So we test those. Now, if we look at an airline pilot, then we're going to look at how well does he or she fly, mm-hmm. and we'll put him in a sim and take a look at him, and that'll be one part of the selection system.
Anybody can, here in the U.S. at least, anybody can go get a pilot's license or at least jump into a school and try to get a pilot's license.
That's correct. That's correct.
In other countries around the world, is it the same? Can anybody go get a pilot's license?
No. In a lot of countries, it is terribly expensive. And the vast majority of people just can't even think about putting their foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also in a lot of countries, because it's so expensive, there is very, very little private aviation. So these countries will have something like a national flying school. And you'll have to apply to the flying school, get accepted. And then if you get through, you'll have a job with their national airline.
Is that somewhat the case of what happened in this case with the Lufthansa? He trained under Lufthansa. Germanwings is a subsidiary, kind of what,
correct.
I guess, United Express is for United.
Basically,
sort of the equivalent here
sort
in the
of
U.S.?
The equivalent.
A lower-cost carrier?
Lower-cost carrier, yes. Lufthansa has had a cadet selection system for many, many years. And for a variety of reasons, they don't have enough military pilots that can fill what they need. And Lufthansa has actually preferred civilian pilots. So they set up a cadet system, and you apply. You go through a very extensive selection process. And then if you pass, you get sent to the school. And if you pass that, then essentially you get hired as a pilot. And in this case, they'll start with Germanwings and then move on to Lufthansa.
And I'm sorry, it's Lufthansa? I always thought it was Lufthansa.
Well, it depends on what part of Germany you're from, what your accent is.
Okay, so when we get to big aviation like this, airlines, right. things like this, they're looking for people who are already pilots,
yes.
right? So you come in with the skill. It's not like you're, hey, I'd like to fly for you someday. Okay, let's train you from the ground up. There's no Jedi training here. It's we need pilots, and then we figure out if they fit into our system or can fly our planes, things like that, right?
Right. For most of those airlines, they're going to train their own people, and they're going to train them from the ground up.
So flight school and everything, or they're already pilots and then they're going to train them?
For like Lufthansa and several other European airlines, they actually train them from the ground up, from zero time, and they'll take them all the way through.
Hmm. So, and this gentleman, he entered here to become a pilot. He was not already a pilot when he started training at Lufthansa school, right?
That's my understanding.
What do you make of the story today that he had reported a severe depression? He had left school for a while, came
mm-hmm.
back.
Mm-hmm.
They knew about a severe depressive bout that he had had.
Mm-hmm.
In your career, would that mm-hmm. have set off a red flag? Would you know, if a company came to you and said, well, we want to think about how to deal with these certain situations.
Mm-hmm. That certainly should have set off a red flag. Now, it apparently occurred while he was in the United States. So it's not clear to me that that information was sent back to Lufthansa headquarters, to the people who were in charge of selection. We've never heard that they actually saw it.
Mm.
So it may be that they were not aware of the situation.
So somebody there might have been, but it might not have gotten to the people that were making the decisions, things like that.
Exactly.
But you would certainly advise, you know, it's interesting because it's a dangerous place, isn't it? Because if we say, well, then he shouldn't have been flying, mm-hmm. then what's going to happen is anybody training who goes through anything, mm-hmm. and here's kind of what happened here, right? Mm-hmm. He wasn't reporting like he should have been.
Right.
So it gets to be a very catch-22 for any airline, because if you come down hard on it, then mm-hmm. the concern is somebody's just going to cover up any problems they have, whether it's marital woes, financial mm-hmm. woes, or mental issues. Why would I want to report it if it might cost me my job?
That's exactly right. And in the United States, we've, over the last 20 years or so, we've, I think, taken a more proactive approach and maybe a little more enlightened approach to these sorts of things. Now, we do have alcoholic airline pilots, very, very rare, but it does happen. And in the old days, they were basically punished. They lost their jobs, et cetera. And so now, starting about 20 years ago, we began to develop programs for them, basically to rehabilitate.
And right now it would be illegal just to fire somebody once they, I mean, unless they did something terrible on the job. If somebody mm-hmm. came to their airline and said, I'm an alcoholic, I need help.
Right.
Would they legally be able to say, you're fired? Or I imagine there's also union issues, but I'm guessing, no, that's a disease. They have to be given the opportunity to go through rehab and reinstate themselves?
I believe that is correct. I'm not sure about
okay.
that. Yeah.
But in relation to this, I mean, what would you advise a company to do when it comes to a matter like this?
Well, usually, these types of things, if he's reporting a severe depression, a clinical depression, where he wants to quit or he has quit for some period of time, apparently he was on antidepressants, that really should have been handled, first of all, by the German medical establishment. So in our case, that wouldn't be immediately the airline that would handle that. It would have to go to the FAA. Mm-hmm. And once he notified people that he was taking these drugs, he was having this problem, they would withhold his first-class medical certificate. And then they, after some period of time, they would want to see that he was stable on whatever medication he was taking. They would evaluate him, they would monitor him, and they would monitor him over a very substantial period of time to make sure he remained stable. And that's what should have happened in Germany, but we're not hearing that is what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's, you know, even if we say we should monitor him over a substantial period of time, mm-hmm. how close is that monitoring? How quickly does whether it's a crisis in the family or whatever that makes mm-hmm. you mentally unstable to the point of suicide, mm-hmm. how quickly does that take hold? I don't know if that's easy to medically say that as long as we screen him once a month or make him come in once mm-hmm. a week to speak with somebody mm-hmm. that he's okay. And that, you know, we're not just talking about pilots, but police officers, mm-hmm. bus drivers, mm-hmm. anybody who is in a place where it's dangerous if they can't perform to their fullest abilities, right?
Right, exactly. And that is, it's very difficult to predict anything that's a sudden decrease in mental health. That's very, very difficult to predict. And even though they would be monitored, I'm not sure that anybody could have predicted.
Here in the U.S., mm-hmm. would that go to the pilots union? Would it be done with the airline? And how hard, I mean, and this may be out of your area, I don't know how much you get okay. into this, but when you're advising airlines on pilots and things like that, mm-hmm. is there concern about once they get in, how strong are those unions and how tough is it if you feel you need to remove a pilot mm-hmm. or somebody from mm-hmm. a crew? How mm-hmm. tough is that to do?
Okay. First of all, at our bigger carriers and some of our larger regionals, we do have a very strong union system. Now, let's say I'm a pilot and one day I come to work. And I notice that one of the other pilots is acting oddly. Let's say he's yelling at people, he seems agitated, there's something wrong. Now, what I can do is I can get on the phone, I can call the union, and a big union will have something called a professional standards committee. I can call them anonymously, I can give my name, doesn't matter. They will contact that pilot immediately. They will talk to that pilot. If they feel that there is a problem, they will call management and they will say, this person needs to be taken off flight status today.
Mm-hmm.
management will act, no questions asked, and then the union will step in, talk to the individual again, and if they think that there's a real issue here, they have resources, mental health individuals who work with them, work with pilots, and they'll start referring that individual to those people.
It seems not to be an issue here in the States. I've never heard of this happening here, and we still don't know exactly what happened here.
Yeah.
I don't like that look. You just rolled your eyes like, well, I wouldn't say it doesn't happen here.
Well, it has happened twice. Now, we're talking twice over about a 35, 40-year period, but we have had two instances. One occurred about 1982. It was on a smaller aircraft, but it was passenger carrying. And then we had another one about, I think it was 1992. That was a cargo aircraft, and that was not successful. But there was an attempt.
There's probably more instances of somebody shows up and there's a little bit of alcohol on their breath or some other issue where that phone call does get placed. Do you feel that that system works well? I would feel if I was a pilot and I suddenly got this call before my flight, I would buck up real quick and sound like everything's fine.
With alcohol, you may notice that a couple of times they've been stopped by screeners as they go through the screening system. So they act pretty normal, but the screeners smell it and stop it. So there are several stages at which they can be stopped.
But if they were distressed or upset, or like you had, the example you had given was maybe they're curt with somebody or yell at somebody as they're getting ready for a flight, something out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
So that phone call suddenly comes.
Right.
I think they understand where that phone call is coming from.
Yes.
In general, you're happy with that system? That seems to work?
It seems to have worked pretty well for us. You know, I think we could do more. I think some of the smaller airlines don't have as strong of unions. Their unions are smaller. They don't have all the professional resources that the big ones have. So I think those could be supported. I think we could also do things with the families, perhaps, to educate the wives and the other family members. So if they notice something out of the ordinary, they can call the union also and try to get help for this person.
And that's such a tough area still. Let's talk. We have to take a quick break, but I want to talk about family involvement because it's in some weird way I can correlate to, say, domestic violence in the NFL. If you know your husband is going to get kicked out of this league or lose all of his financial wherewithal, are you going to report the domestic violence? It's a real tough situation. We'll talk about that next.
Okay.
You can jump in as well. 312-981-7200 is the call-in and text line. Diane Damos is in studio with us from Damos Aviation Services. How do you select the pilots that are up in the air with us? Matt Bubala with you, Radio 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, Radio 720 WGN. We're speaking with Diane Damos of Damos Aviation Services. DamosAviation.com is their website if you're looking to select pilots. I guess I don't know why exactly people need to go to the website, but if you want to, it's there for you. You were saying off the air that Lufthansa actually has an incredibly good pilot selection process.
They have one of the best civilian systems in the world.
And what does that mean? How is that any different than the one here or another airline, you know, or Air Ireland or anybody like that? What's the difference?
Well, they do have a cadet program. So people are being trained from the get-go to fly for Lufthansa. Now, to apply, you have to be able to qualify for a German university, first of all, by your academic grades. So that's the equivalent of Harvard, Yale, Princeton. It's that level. And then they will put you through days and days of testing. And that's abilities, skills testing. They'll look at you in group situations. You will interview with clinical psychologists. Clinical psychologists will watch you while you do certain things. Current airline captains will watch you. And of the people who start, and remember this is a very select group to begin with, about 11% will get through.
And he's one of those 11%.
He's one of those 11% who made it through, and he made it through the interviews with the clinical psychologists.
So despite the problems he had in taking the leave and coming back,
right,
he apparently either was doing much better and this just recently came back on or whatever, but he passed their tests. And so any airline would have employed him, basically, by most likely, because they have such a stringent policy there. You think pretty much anybody would have put him in the sky in general.
Yeah.
I know you can't say exactly.
I think he was very good at presenting himself in a very positive way. And then once he got into the cadet program and had been in it a number of months, then you had this depressive episode. Now, it's not uncommon for people to stop flying for a while they're in training. In the U.S., it happens all the time, and it's usually because people run out of money, because we're basically self-funded. Mm-hmm. Over there, Lufthansa probably would have been paying all of it or the majority of it. But flight training can be very stressful.
Sounds like especially there, right?
Yes, it would be, and because they still do fail people out of that program, too. So it wouldn't surprise me that he would stop for a while. And again, we don't know what Lufthansa knew about right. the reason for stopping.
He might have just said to them, I just need to take a break. I'm just tired. I'm worn out, or this is too much. The severe depressive episode that's been reported, mm-hmm. maybe that went to other people, or it just wasn't really paid attention to until now. They're digging through emails, digging through whatever did we know.
Exactly.
And finding it.
Exactly. And the fact that this occurred in the United States, I would wonder how much communication there was between the U.S. and the folks back in Germany.
Mm. Texter from the 847, David, says, I'm wondering if a pilot can be reported by civilians. So we're talking about, you had said that, within the U.S. here, if somebody notices distress of a pilot or problem with a pilot, there's a number they can call
yeah.
quietly that will get in touch with the mm-hmm. pilot and then figure out if he should be removed from flying that day, mm-hmm. he or she.
Mm-hmm.
Like someone comes across a pilot in the bathroom and sees him acting distraught or bothered, mm-hmm. would the report be taken seriously? If a civilian who's going to get on a plane notices
right.
something questionable or mm-hmm. that worries them about their pilot,
mm-hmm.
and I imagine that's happening every day right now as people are reading about this.
Yeah.
But is there a place that people would call, or how would people, if you were a civilian, what would you recommend that they do?
Yeah. That's a tough one, because who would you call?
Mm-hmm.
I think what you would have to do is either find another pilot with the same airline and talk to him, or possibly with the people that are, taking the tickets, one of the managers for that, and tell them what you saw. Now, at big airports like O'Hare here, that's a hub.
Mm-hmm.
So actual airline management is right there. And I would think that that report might get to them relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm. If I was getting on that plane, mm-hmm. I think I'd just not get on that plane. Honestly, it would be tough, wouldn't it, if you saw a pilot acting, and I don't want to put a bunch of thoughts in people's heads here. It's
right.
a weird conversation, but as a flyer, and mm-hmm. maybe if this wasn't in our heads right now, I wouldn't think twice about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're on a flight with an angry pilot right now, you're thinking, oh, well, that makes me nervous. You want them to be cool and calm and collected at all times.
And they usually are.
Yeah.
I mean, I have seen situations, for example, where the pilot goes to taxi away from the gate, and they find out that the ground crew didn't put the right amount of fuel in and didn't do what they were told to do, and comes back. Well, he can get angry about that, mm-hmm. and rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
It's when it seems to be totally disproportionate that I think I'd start getting concerned.
We've got to take a break for the news, but when we come back, what are the regulations overseas and what are the regulations here? Why might this not have happened if he had been flying in the U.S.? We'll talk about that after the news with Diane Damos of Damos Aviation here on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, Radio 720 WGN. Pardon me for my fascination with the German wings story. Diane, this is such a weird thing about me, and I hope to God I'm dead wrong on this and it never happens. But for 15 to 20 years now, I have had a premonition that I will witness a plane crash someday in my life.
Oh, goodness.
And I hope I never do. I really do. But I have dreams about it often.
Wow.
Where I'll be driving down the expressway, mm-hmm. and I'll see something happen. I've mm-hmm. had this in dreams. And so this type of thing really always freaks me out. So, We've been talking about Diane Damos is with Damos Aviation. She helps select pilots, or helps companies, schools, airlines figure out how they're going to select their pilots. You
right.
don't actually select anybody. Have
no.
you ever select? Have you ever like, boy, that one, that's a good flyer right there.
No,
you haven't done that. Maybe you should.
Maybe I should.
Let's talk a little bit about why this happened overseas. And maybe, we can't say for sure, mm-hmm. but maybe it would not have happened here. What's the difference in the regulations mm-hmm. in Europe versus here?
Okay. After 9/11, the airlines agreed that there would be no more single person in the cockpit. So if for some reason one of the pilots had to come out of the cockpit, the idea was he would call one of the flight attendants up, probably from first class. As he came out, that flight attendant would go in and lock the door. And then she would watch what would happen. So after he came back, the flight attendant would be watching. She could see whether he was by himself or not. And then she could, of course, see who it was. So then if it was the right person and he was by himself, she would open the door for him then and let him in. So there was always to be those two people, and so that the other guy could concentrate on flying the airplane.
Mm. Interesting. Do you think that would have prevented what happened here?
I think it would have been a deterrent. And the sad thing here is that it was like the Europeans didn't learn from what happened to us.
Because we enacted that law after 9/11, right?
Exactly. And the day after this occurred, Canadian Department of Transportation enacted a rule for them. And about eight other airlines around the world enacted a procedure for themselves also. And I suspect we'll see that several countries will put this into law the same way we have it. But they could have learned it from us, but they just didn't.
Did Lufthansa enact it?
I believe yes, they have enacted it.
Right away?
Yes.
But at the same time, if he and I think we think it would have been a deterrent because he was so calm about it.
Right.
Right. He mm-hmm. was very quiet about everything, mm-hmm. played along like everything mm-hmm. was fine.
Right.
And then suddenly and very gradually, you said he put it on autopilot. Mm-hmm. He doesn't fly the plane straight down into the mountain.
No.
It's very calm. He puts it on autopilot right. and just guides it down.
Right.
And he's not even at the controls, we think, then when it hits the mountain, right?
Right.
He's just
probably
sitting
not.
There as a passenger.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that is a deterrent, or maybe he knocks out whoever comes in there and has some way of doing that. We just don't know.
Don't know. But if there had even been a flight attendant up there, she could have unlatched the door. She could have done the override, unless mm-hmm. he had knocked her unconscious immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
that's going to be difficult to do.
Will they change the override policy? Because there's no way to get in there quick enough, right? The door can be overridden, but it's at least
yeah.
5 minutes before, if the pilot enacts a way to keep it shut, it's at least 5 minutes before somebody from the outside can override that, right?
I'm not entirely sure, but the thing we do have to do here is keep our eyes on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest threat to us is still terrorism.
Sure.
Now, as bad as this was, we still have terrorists out there that would be very happy to bring down airliners.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to be very careful if we make any changes in this to make sure that we're not making it easier for the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if some pilot has a code that means they can get back in, then they just threaten that person's life, do whatever it takes.
Right.
If somebody knows the code and we can get in,
yep.
then that's a greater risk to take.
That is a risk.
When you are when they're selecting pilots,
mm-hmm.
so how much is about my physical ability to fly a plane
mm-hmm.
versus my mental ability to mm-hmm. make split second decisions, to multitask
mm-hmm.
the eight different things that could be going on?
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about off the air in Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about airplane crashes
mm-hmm.
and about how it never seems to be, well, this one thing went wrong.
Right.
You rarely say this one thing went wrong.
That's
right.
Correct.
It's a series of things, weather, pilots working together mm-hmm. who aren't familiar with each other, an indicator light out on a plane that somebody didn't notice.
Right.
It seems that most crashes, seven or eight things tend to pile up, and that's when things end up going awry.
Right.
So how much of it today is about a pilot's ability to make all these decisions versus their ability to take the stick when they have to?
Well, first of all, we look at things slightly differently for someone who doesn't know how to fly, so somebody who wants to go to a training school versus an experienced pilot, okay? So with somebody who doesn't know how to fly, we're going to be looking at their psychomotor skills pretty carefully because in this culture, and in fact in most cultures, we don't use a lot of eye-hand-foot coordination.
To okay? fly a plane? Or you mean in regular life?
In
regular
life,
we don't. Okay.
Okay. And in some countries, there's very, very little, far
mm-hmm.
less than there is here.
Do you need a lot of eye-hand-foot coordination to fly a plane?
You still do, yes.
Okay.
You still do. And so they need that. They need to be able to think in three-dimensional space. They need to be able to read technical material. There's a lot of things we look at for them. Now, with an airline, the person has already proven that they can do some of that. So we're going to be concentrating on other factors for an airline. We're going to put you in a simulator and see if you really can fly as well as you should be able to.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be testing very specific knowledge to see if you really do know everything that you should know at this stage. And there are some people who don't. You know, they've made it through and they've forgotten stuff or whatever. And then we're going to be looking at how well we think you're going to interact in a crew. Okay, because now the crew issue becomes important. So are you somebody that I want to fly with? Or do I think you're such a jerk I don't ever want to get in a cockpit with you?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the types of things. The emphasis has changed somewhat when you look at an airline pilot versus a student.
How did they figure that out? Because I understand we're going to put you in the simulator and we're going to throw a thunderstorm at mm-hmm. you and wind shear mm-hmm. and, you know, a pilot lights going out on the dashboard, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we figure out How do airlines figure out how you're going to be with a crew?
They look at how you interact with interviewers. And typically, at a very late stage in the selection process, you will have what's called the captain or the technical interview. And so you will be faced with anywhere from 2 to about 5 people who are asking you questions and listening to your answers, probing you, and scoring you on different things. And these are experienced people, and they're going to give you hypothetical situations and then listen to what your answers are. And then from that, they're going to try to determine whether they think you're going to work well in a crew.
That's interesting, because if it's an interview, then I know I got to put on my interview face, right?
That's right.
I get along with everybody. I'm a team player, Diane.
Yes, but not everybody does that.
And people actually, and I guess that's really how you know, is if, well,
yep.
if you can't pull this off in the interview where you know I'm looking for you to be a good person.
Exactly.
Then it's bad. But when, so then when they hire them, you know, how sure are they? Or is there a general way that you get, I imagine you don't throw them in and you're the pilot, you're the co-pilot,
you're
something
co-pilot.
For a long time till we know not only your technical skills, but he works well in a group. A senior pilot says, yes, he can become, he's pilot material.
Well, actually for most airlines, they have a 1-year probationary period. So during this probationary period, they're not protected by the union and therefore they can be fired relatively easily.
Mm.
And during the 1 year, they will monitor the technical skills. The captains that the person is flying with will evaluate them periodically. And then at the end of the period, there may be another flight test where they actually do get someone on board a flight with this person, observe what they're doing. They may bring them back and put them through another sim test. There's a variety of things they can do. So they have about a year to sort this through.
All in all, when you look at what happened mm-hmm. with Andreas Lubitz mm-hmm. and Lufthansa, well, German Wings, the mm-hmm. subsidiary of Lufthansa, do you say, you know what, this is the rare thing that's going to happen once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to be able to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe change the law so that there's always somebody in the cockpit.
Right.
But overall, once in a while, things happen, whether it's a bus driver
mm-hmm.
or a plane driver or
mm-hmm.
whoever,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to be able to catch 100% of everything.
Yes, and what you have to remember is we have about 100,000 flights a day worldwide, okay? Now, I've been at this since 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can think of, in the civilian world, 3 attempted suicides in 40-some years at, nowadays, 100,000 flights a day.
Mm-hmm.
These are incredibly rare events, and they're just because they are so rare, they're just extremely difficult for us to detect.
Yeah. You've seen the movie Flight with Denzel Washington?
Oh, I have.
And what'd you think of it?
Yes. Well,
I guess let me ask 2 questions.
Mm-hmm.
One is, do you feel like that is kind of a common issue that people would be alarmed if they knew how much of an issue that was with pilots and drinking or all the travel you do all the way from home and the issues pilots face? And 2 is really, oh, God, that's so Hollywood. That would never happen this way.
Well, I do think he would have been detected. That co-pilot realized something was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a very good chance he would have reported him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this person obviously had a history. This was not one time something.
Mm-hmm.
He was at this for a long time. So somewhere the evidence would have come out and people would have said something, you know, and it would have come up to management, I think, pretty quickly, or it would have gone to the union.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is a case where the guy could have called the union and say, hey, there's something wrong here. We need to get him out of the cockpit.
Mm-hmm. And so you think that would have happened in real life, but that wouldn't have been good for the movie.
Not good for them.
Kind of would have ended
no.
really early on. 312-981-7200. We've got a few more minutes with Diane Damos from Damos Aviation Services Incorporated here in the Chicagoland area. When we come back off the air, we talked a little bit about the Malaysian Airlines flight
right.
from last year.
Right.
I had a guest on recently about that who had one theory. You have a very different one, and I want to mm-hmm. hear yours next on 720 WGN. few more minutes with Diane Damos from Damos Aviation Services here in the Chicagoland area. It's been a fascinating hour here with Diane. Tim is on 720 WGN. Tim, what did you want to ask Diane?
Hi. I just wanted to ask, like, with that two-pilot in the cockpit rule or two-person, however you want to word it, say, you know, like a similar situation happens, the pilot steps out to use the restroom, and somebody has to go into the cockpit, they have stewardess. Now, I'm not trying to sound like chauvinistic or sexist, but most of the stewardess are kind of dainty. What's to stop, like, the other pilot from maybe knocking her out, locking the door, and doing a similar, you know, act like this guy has done?
Yeah, and we kind of talked about that earlier, too. I mean, in essence, if he can do that, nothing stops him, really, right?
Right, yeah. But remember, they're also strapped in, so he's got to be able to unstrap, get up, and get to that flight attendant. And the flight attendants are not necessarily that passive. I know quite a few of them, so it's going to be a struggle. Now, the trouble is, while they're struggling, what happens to the airplane? You know, if he's already put it into a descent, then you're going to have a problem. I mean, it's not a good situation, but I think having another person there is definitely a deterrent.
Yeah, it at least is a deterrent. We don't know what it truly does in the end, but in this instance, it might have helped. We don't know. But once that door is locked, there's nothing that you can truly do.
No.
Because you can't break down that door. They were trying, and that's
tried.
So we're glad the doors work. The terrorists are going to be kept out, but in this one in a million instance,
unfortunately,
this is going to happen.
Exactly.
Flight MH317, I believe it was, Malaysian Airlines, a little bit over a year ago. A couple weeks ago on the show, I had David Susi on. He's the CNN aviation safety expert who's been on the air again a lot recently, and he wrote a book about what happened, and he tries to look at it very factually, as he has with other airline disasters over the years. And his conclusion is he believes that what happened was a fire in the cockpit. He says that all of these things going out at once could have only been done by two people, but he doesn't believe it was done by both of these pilots. He believes there was a fire in the cockpit that knocked things out. They didn't have time to radio that, so they go into, or they get knocked out by air pressure, things like that. He believes that, he said there was another flight that flew into a mountain many years ago where they were following it. They knew that one person in the back had gotten oxygen and survived and tried to work their way all the way up to the front and then couldn't do anything. He thinks it was a similar situation. Probably everybody gets knocked out. Somebody is able to get into the cockpit. And his theory is they didn't want to crash into land, so they set it on a course over the ocean. Now, I personally find that hard to believe, because if I'm surviving in that plane, I'm trying to survive. I'm not giving up and saying, okay, this is what happens. What's your take on what happened?
Well, first of all, you'd have to know where you were and which way land was, you know, and you'd have to have someone who knew how to operate the controls, how to operate. And that's not intuitively obvious. So it's not like you have just a passenger is going to come up if they don't have any type of flight training. And even they'd have to have more than just basic flight training.
And even a flight attendant not necessarily going to know how to do any of
that, correct? They would not know how to do it. So I guess when I looked at the investigation, I was kind of surprised at how much time they spent focusing on the captain. And I don't think it was the captain. I think the problem was the co-pilot. And within about a day after that accident occurred, I got a phone call from Australia, and they had found at that time the photographs on Facebook that showed this co-pilot had let women into the cockpit, okay, in flight. Now, if that had happened in the United States, he would have been fired so fast it would be unbelievable. But here's somebody who has a history of doing this. Now, either the airlines, this was basically approved, or it was winked at, because I will guarantee that every flight attendant knew that he had done that. And if you have one set of photographs, how many more times has he done that? You know, and the captain had to know that he was bringing women up there. So why didn't the captain report that? This is not a safety issue. This is a safety issue. So my suspicion, first of all, was that this could be another time where he decided to open the door and let some good-looking woman in, except the woman may have had a couple of buddies, and that this is a hijacking that, in essence, went wrong. But letting women into the cockpit, I mean, opening that door in flight is ridiculous. I mean, he's had a history of doing this. Secondly, The captain is a grandfather. He's a devoted family man. He's devoted to aviation. This is not the type of a person who would do a hijacking or do a suicide. It's usually the younger men that you have to look at carefully, and this is what the co-pilot was. And yet, he received, as far as I could tell, very little attention.
Okay, let's take your theory out. So maybe he lets the wrong person in.
Yep.
And then these people know enough to shut everything down as far as transponders, things like that, communication. Because several things, it sounded like, had to be turned off at once, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe you don't know if there was a struggle. I mean,
right.
There could have been. Several things could have gone wrong here. And as I think it might have been a hijacking that went wrong, that something else happened up there. And these, whoever it was, couldn't control the aircraft. And that's why you ended up with the mess you were in. But I've been very concerned, you know, right from a day afterwards that this was a co-pilot problem.
Not that he did it, but that he is the one who screwed up.
He screwed up.
And so you think that it was a hijacking gone awry and it did fly out over the ocean, ran out of gas and crashed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if it had landed someplace, we would have known by now.
Would we?
I think we would have, because you can't land that airplane, you know, on a 200-foot dirt strip.
You also can't land it in the ocean without it disintegrating into a lot of pieces, and we haven't found a piece.
That's correct. Actually, you can land them. We have had ones. They're very old, but where they did land, if it's smooth.
Right. And David Susie was telling me the engines on this are made to break off, so you cannot, you know, flip it over and things like that, and that can happen, although this is incredibly choppy water.
Right.
And we should have then found something.
Well, I think the problem was that there was a hurricane a couple days later, remember? And anything that was floating, I think, when you hit a hurricane, there's a good chance it would have sunk or it would have been dispersed in such a manner that they wouldn't have necessarily seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another issue with it. It's spread out over too big of an
you
area.
You think we'll find out someday, right?
I kind of think we will.
Is it going to be an Amelia Earhart thing where private industry is looking for years? Or do you think that within a year and the actual investigation's going on, we figure out something?
I have a hunch. I do think it's down in the ocean. I think, you know, the American submarine fleet will find it by accident, or the Russians will find it, or somebody will locate
it. Let's hope it's not the Russians, because then the conspiracy theories will go on for, it is.
Yeah, sure it is.
Diane Damos with Damos Aviation Services. Thank you so much for being with us. Fascinating conversation.
You're entirely welcome.
We appreciate
it. My pleasure.